I'd like for us to just think for a moment about where we were some number of months ago when we were able to go to the building on Wednesday night and have a class. I was thinking tonight about the ability to put work down and be able to concentrate and enjoy the time together with other Christians, the ability to study and to think about God's Word. And I don't know about you, but there's something about rushing home, and or if we're already at home because we've been here most of the day, perhaps working from home, and then trying to just simply turn on the computer and be part of this class tonight, that doesn't seem as much of a put down the things of the world and go and do something that's really different and focused just on God. But this is nevertheless, this is time we have together. And it's not that we're completely unable to give full thought to God and be able to kind of put aside some other thoughts in the world. And for you, you may be able to concentrate even better. I don't know. I really miss not just being able to study, but I miss the time of just hanging around the building with everybody. So this is a poor substitute. I think we all realize that. The subject, of course, is godly relationships, which is not really necessarily the idea of us as Christians all being together. It's more about how Christians work their relationships with one another throughout their life, all kinds of relationships, whether it's with godly people or not. How do we form those relationships that are godly? And yet at the same time, I can't help but be pondering and thinking about kind of what we're missing in terms of our relationships with each other. So what I'll ask you to do, again, if you're comfortable, some of you I know can't because you're on a car or your phone doesn't really support it well, but the more of you that can show up on video, there's a lot of you now that are, I think it's better for everybody. It just kind of gives us a real sense of being together a little more than we otherwise would have. I want to go back and talk about, just briefly, the organization of the class. And is there like a red streak running across the middle of this that y'all can see there? No idea where that came from. So we'll see. It'll probably just remain for the rest of this. Later I'll figure out how to get that deleted somehow. But just ignore it. You'll notice that the class tonight is on purity and the nature of men and women. I want to clarify that really these are two different, totally different topics. The purity is a continuation discussion about part of the character we want to start building. We talked about godliness last week. We're going to talk some about purity. Look at lessons 3, 4, and 5. You'll see we're going to spend time talking about selflessness and humility and kindness and forbearance, just a number of character traits that are especially important in relationships. When we talk about purity, that's what we're talking about. I'm not trying to link purity with the nature of men and women. That's a separate topic. Tonight we want to talk about the differences just in general between men and women, and how that may have some factor in how we are able to form relationships, in some of the dangers of some relationships, in the differences that men and women face in terms of temptations and whatever relationships they're in. Now, I just wanted to ask you, why do you think it might be important in a class about relationships to at least spend a little bit of time talking about the differences between men and women? And there you can't give a bad answer to this question, by the way. This is, why do you think it might be worthwhile to talk just a little bit about the differences of men and women if we're going to talk about godly relationships? Thoughts?
Hey, Russ.
Yes.
You know, God created men and women differently and with, at least in some respects, different roles to be played. And as such, you know, those God-given differences between men and women are going to have an influence on us in every other relationship that we have. You know, I can try to be a mother, but I'm probably got a better chance of being a good father. You know, I can try to do certain things, but, you know, we're just not the same. And those basic differences, while, you know, they're not entirely 100% all the time kinds of things, really do help us to understand each other and approach each other in more appropriate ways.
Yes, because you kind of touched a little bit on the different roles, but also just how valuable it can be in understanding each other. Other thoughts about why it may be valuable for us to study and think about the differences?
Russ, it seems that the first type of relationship on earth was between a man and a woman. And I would say it's probably the most common relationship in the world between a husband and wife. And it'd be good to us to study about that purity and the nature, the different nature of between men and women.
Yeah, so there's one specific relationship, one we're really not going to spend a lot of time talking about in this class. The marriage relationship is certainly there. This would be important, and we will touch on that briefly in lesson 8. Other thoughts?
Well, it seems like in godly relationships, you would be helping people like achieve their full potential and like bring out the best. So it would be useful to have a good idea of kind of what to encourage people towards.
Yes. Again, a little bit of that understanding, but then putting some of that into action as you were describing it there. So I'll leave it at that. I mean, you're helping to justify doing this. And I think when we actually talk some about the differences, hopefully you'll begin to see some ways in which we can apply it to the material that we'll go through throughout the 13 lessons. But let's do a little bit of a review and go back to this beginning part of a chart that we covered on Sunday. So I want you to think for a moment about the people that are in your life. The people that you know in your life, if you were to describe them across the spectrum from those that are extremely ungodly to those to whom God means everything and have put God as the focus of their life. And, of course, all of those individuals, which would be most folks who fit somewhere in between with different strengths or weaknesses in terms of their life. But think about how those individuals might have influence over you, different types of people. And so we spent a little bit of time on Sunday trying to describe those that we might recognize are ungodly. Things like those who just practice certain types of immorality and aren't embarrassed about it at all. There's no shame that they think that it's perfectly appropriate to do that. And their idea of good or fun or success is completely a worldly idea and have no interest whatsoever in the truth. I'm sure you know some people that would be described, if not completely by that, at least to some degree, that describes some of the people in your life. There are a lot of people who probably fit somewhere in the middle. And it's important to think about that there are those who perhaps are not really that ungodly, but to whom God is not at the center of their life. You know, they're as this third bullet point says, somewhat religious or morally compliant. It's kind of like when it really helps, well, then they're concerned about doing the right thing, but, you know, they don't want to be a fanatic about it. So they're careful and are more willing to make compromises with the world in terms of how they conduct themselves. And then, of course, there are a number of ways of thinking of those that are extremely godly. And I think we're blessed in our relationships at Embry Hills to know a lot of people who very much are described this way as they're trying to follow God and to live for Christ in a complete way. So, again, if you think about the people in your life, they would fit somewhere across the spectrum of ungodly to godly. and a lot of folks somewhere in the middle. Another thing that we looked at was the idea of the strength of relationships. Whoops. Let me go back one more. Yeah, no, there we go. So those individuals that are in your life, some of them have virtually no influence over you whatsoever. I suppose there's a lot of folks like that. You know, you may go see a barber once a month. He really doesn't have a whole lot of influence over you and other than just for a few minutes in a week, once a month. There are other folks, though, that you're with all the time and that you respect a great deal. And whatever they say or do is going to have a high degree of influence over you. And we tried to list a few things that might speak to just how much influence somebody has over you or how much influence you have on them. A lot of it depends on just how often you're with that person and for how long and the kinds of conversations or shared experiences that you have. I think most of us recognize that if you've ever been with somebody and kind of shared your life history, gave them your story, and they shared something with you, maybe even something that they haven't shared with a lot of other people, that tends to bond two people together. And you would naturally have more influence with somebody that you trusted or that trusted you to share some of the secrets or things in their life that other people don't know. So there are a lot of ways of thinking of what provides this level or strength of influence. So anybody got any questions about those two things? Again, you can think about the people you know as being across the spectrum from ungodly to godly. But you can also think about the people you know in terms of the degree to which they influence you or you're able to influence them. Any thoughts or questions about those two things? Okay, so what we tried to do then was to combine them into this grid. And so let's see if I can get that off of there. There we go. So here's the grid, four quadrants. So up there in the red, of course, would be individuals who are characterized to some degree by the ungodliness in their life or the immorality, yet they have a pretty high influence over us. On the other hand, we may know people like that who don't have much of any influence, and that would be down there in that yellow quadrant. In the far right bottom, in the green, would be somebody that maybe we don't know them that well. They don't have a lot of influence. We don't see them that often. But we do have a relationship with them, and we know them to be good or godly people. And then there are those that are godly who have a great deal of influence over us. That would be the group there in blue. And so I put that question up at the beginning of the class. Can you help me by thinking through somebody who would fit in that red category first? What kind of a relationship might you have that would fit into that red square there? Somebody who has a lot of influence over you but may not be that godly of a person.
Maybe a coworker or your boss.
Okay. So if your coworker or your boss is not living in a way in which God matters to them, why would you put them in the red?
I mean, you're usually going to spend kind of at least 8 hours a day with them, and so it's a lot of hours during the week that you could be in close quarters or working on a lot of projects together, and there's a lot of interaction.
Yeah, I think that's right. So of those two, Andrew, the boss and the coworker, which one's likely to have more influence over you?
So you might spend more time with a coworker, but the boss has kind of has some authority over you. So yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe the best answer to that is it depends,
right,
on that, because you know sometimes you're so close to a coworker or think so well of them despite their the immorality in their life that they have more influence. But a boss certainly has some leverage, if you will. Yeah. Okay, what about the yellow quadrant there? Can you think of some relationships that don't really have that much influence, but you are around people that are not people who really care that much about following God.
I think of like a neighbor, someone that's close to you.
Yeah. So you may even observe a lot of the things that they're doing, but if you're not close to them and you don't talk to them, it may not matter that much to you what they're doing, right? That's a good example. What about somebody in the green, somebody that would have more of a good influence, a good person, but really the strength of that relationship isn't that strong?
Maybe an evangelist that you listen to online.
Okay. Yeah, so you don't really have much of any relationship with them because of that. I suppose if their teaching was really powerful and strong, they might actually have a fair amount of influence over you, but more than likely, if you just don't know them that well, you're right, that may fit there. You just kind of know of them.
Members of our congregation that we may not have a relationship with, but they're very godly, but we don't know yet.
Everything you know and see of them speaks to their godliness, and yet really you don't know them that well, haven't talked to them that often, maybe you haven't even really met them yet, you know, some of the newer members and all. And then finally, the blue category, can you think about that? Who might fit there? I thought
you hope your spouse
will on Sunday, Jason Randolph.
I'm not allowed to say my wife again.
Okay. So, well, I won't count that as you having said it again. But
I'll say your wife. I'll say Katie.
Okay. Okay. If you have a spouse who cares a great deal about God, obviously a spouse exercises a great deal of influence over us. And the degree to which they are godly or ungodly matters. I think that goes back to some of that discussion about being unequally yoked to someone. Why it's dangerous sometimes to marry somebody who just doesn't care about God at all, because they're going to exercise a high degree of influence. But if you have a faithful, godly spouse, that would certainly fit. So here are the categories. I guess I could have put those up a little bit earlier. But I want you to just kind of take a look at all of these different categories. Y'all mentioned some of these even the other day. I think somebody mentioned the immoral roommate. And if you'll notice here, there's actually like two different roommates mentioned. You could have an immoral roommate that's like way over to the left in terms of their ungodliness. But really, they're close to the yellow line here because maybe even because they're so immoral, they don't have that much influence over you. You just recognize from the beginning, oh, I got paired together with this person I didn't really mean to be. And so they have to have some influence as a roommate. But what if it was your best friend as a roommate who really didn't care that much about God? You can see that up here. That person may not be as ungodly as this other roommate, but I would kind of say the danger is much greater from somebody who is your best friend but a worldly roommate. You see that distinction? And I think it's important for us to think through carefully the relationships in our life and where they may fit on a spectrum like this. Because there is something that the scriptures tell us that we ought to do given where somebody is. And, here's a couple of other names. There's the godly spouse or a godly parent as well. Another influence, a highly influential influence for the good could be there in that far right corner of the blue. So what I'd like you to do is to think for a moment. Let's go here. What do you think we should be concerned about? What actions do you think we should take if we recognize that we have a relationship with somebody that just really doesn't care about God, maybe even mocks the things of God, but we do understand that this person has a lot of influence or a lot of potential influence, what might be an action that the scriptures would tell us to take in that circumstance? Any ideas?
Avoid associating with those people to the extent you can.
Yeah, it's interesting. So I'm going to put this up in a second. I think you'll see that's kind of mentioned right away, Steve, the idea of avoiding. Part of us, I think, initially considers, all right, in all relationships, I need to be working to save the other person. Remember I told you that salvation is like of paramount importance for us and for others. But the scriptures are also clear that I have to be cautious and that there are circumstances in which it is important for me to do just what you said, to have no fellowship. And in fact, there's a number of places in which the Christians, we are told about other Christians who are divisive or who have refused to practice the right kind of morality. Remember all those passages we went through on Sunday looking at certain relationships in which we were told to back off and to have no fellowship. I think these other two bullet points are important here as well, or to the major category. The idea of taking defensive measures. If I recognize that somebody is in my life, especially somebody that's going to remain there, you know, it's one thing to say have no fellowship with them, but what if it's an ungodly spouse? What if it's a boss that I can't remove them from my life? You know, there are relationships in which we have little control. There's that roommate that, you know, the college has assigned us to for the next year. In that case, I need to be sure that I'm defining boundaries and reducing perhaps the interaction and not allowing the degree of influence to grow, but to cause it to diminish. At the same time, and this does go back to our responsibility to everybody, we're also told in Romans to overcome evil with good. And so as we are associating and with people that we sometimes have no choice in, we need to be acting with courage to do the right thing. Here it kind of speaks of courageous kindness, even when it might not be appreciated, but to act in a way that perhaps would help to influence that person. Yet primarily what we're doing is being cautious and careful. Good reason for this being in red, if you will. On the other hand, nobody saw that, right? Nobody read what it said there in yellow? Good. Yeah. What would you do? What do you think that we should think about doing if somebody is in our life, doesn't have a lot of influence over us, but isn't really a person who's following Christ and doing and living their way the way that they should? What should be my goals? What should be my attitude and possible actions related to that person?
Be a good example.
Okay. Yeah, here again, maybe I was concerned about actions before as an example, but I was kind of trying to overcome evil again. I mean, a little different twist on this good example here, as Aaron was talking about. What else?
I would get them to stay with you, encourage them to stay with you, show them the difference in what they're doing and what you're doing.
Okay, so maybe there's an opportunity to increase my interaction with them in a way that actually begins to lead them toward God. So I'm trying to exercise some influence there in some way. Anybody else? What else should I maybe part of my strategy and possible actions?
I just keep thinking. Sorry.
Go ahead, Philip.
I just keep thinking of Ephesians 5:11, do not participate in the unfruitful deeds of darkness, but instead even expose them. So, like, there are people that they don't really know what's wrong with that, and to bring that to their mind.
Yeah, that's good. To whatever extent you can, there's that opportunity. I think that what we're asked to do is to shine as lights. This is a situation in which really our example, as Aaron was talking about, could be something that really stands out to them and attracts them to God. Might go on the offensive. You know, you mentioned have a study with them, look for those kinds of opportunities. Well, that's a little bit more of I want to be influential in their life. And you can think about some of the others. I don't want to use up all of our time on this, but obviously, if there are those that we know that are godly and we don't really have much of a relationship with them, we're seeking to increase it. You know, this idea of Romans 12, of weeping with those who weep and rejoicing with those who rejoice, is actually beginning to know each other well enough to know when somebody's weeping, when somebody's rejoicing, and doing what I can to join in that so that we are building our relationship together. I can be more influenced by them and vice versa so that we can edify and build one another up, the very picture of the church in Ephesians 5. And, of course, if you know those that are godly, well, what you want to do is you want to learn how to, and they have great influence over you. Not only listen to them, but you want to understand how they do the things that they do. That's their example, but you might be asking, okay, well, they did a good job raising their children. How did they do that? Good decisions in terms of how they've gotten involved in helping other people. How did they do that? And looking for ways to follow more fully the example that they have. Here's a simple way of kind of...
Hey, Russ.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I just hoping I could add one thing to the left-hand side. I think we can add praying for people on the entire left-hand side, whether we have whatever our strength of relationship is with them.
Yeah, and it occurs to me, Jason, that not only should we be praying for them, but we should pray for ourselves, and I think our prayer for ourselves would be a little bit different depending on whether we saw them in the red or the yellow. Like in the red, we want to be asking God to help us, to keep us from being overwhelmed by that influence, and on the other hand, being able to actually accomplish some good things. So that's a good point, praying for them, and also I think praying for ourselves.
Hey, Russ.
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, it is. I thought I was on video earlier. Sorry.
No.
Oh, yeah. Hey. Okay. I was going to say, you know, even the basis of this or the premise for us as Christians is the desire to even expand our own relationships, right? Because sometimes it's us four, no more, or it's our group, and we're the only ones that get together, and I don't really want to get to know anybody else, and you know, I'll do a little something for them, but I don't really want to get to know someone because there's always that chance that they've got to forbear some differences and you got some annoyances that are going to happen. And I used to say to our girls when they were growing up, you know, if you say your sister's annoying, guess what? Your sister thinks you're annoying, you know, so it just can go back and forth. So with that said, it is our desire, knowing that it's going to take relating to someone to even get to the point where you can discuss something with them. You can show them how you're living, but where you get to a point where you know them well enough, that happens with us in Christianity, knowing our members, our brothers and sisters,
right.
But even knowing a person, if you don't know them, you don't have an opening. And then secondly, and I think Philip talked about this, is knowing what's evil and knowing what's good. You know, for those that have not grown up as Christians, you don't know that that's actually an evil thing that you're doing or is being done, and why you're for you to break away from that person is because you did this all the time. You grew up this way,
right?
But when you learn as a Christian that it's wrong, now it's an even harder challenge to tell all of your old friends or people that you know, hey, this was wrong. So I think we just have to be willing to expand our relationships.
That's well put. And it's not just simply helping them to understand that something is wrong, but also helping them to understand you can change. Because there's also this picture that we just are what we are, and we can't change. Here's a couple of directions in this. Think about it this way. If you're around somebody who's really ungodly and not doing the right thing, maybe they don't understand it, but they have a lot of influence over you, the focus is on reducing their influence. If you kind of bring them down to somebody who's not going to put you in danger, well, then you can begin to be able to go on the offensive and try to help this person become a godly person. But as long as they remain somebody who's likely to pull you away from God, you should be reducing your interaction with them, avoiding them. But if you can bring them into a situation in which that's turned around, now you have an opportunity. On the other hand, and I think this is a little bit of back to what Vera was saying, how many people would we like to have a relationship up there in the blue? I mean, is there a number that's like a max? You know, I can't have more than 10 people up there. Wouldn't you want to just have your life full of relationships with people who deeply influence you and over whom you have a lot of influence, who really care about God and are concerned about Him? So, you know, let's think about those folks in our life that we're glad for the good things they're doing, but we're not close to them, and see if we can't increase the fellowship, pull them out of the green and up there into the blue. Okay. I can tell by my time, I'm going to skip over purity, because I can come back to that as a quality that we'll talk about in relation to some of these other things. But I want to spend at least a little bit of time tonight talking about the differences of men and women and why I think it matters in terms of what we face in relationships and what we face in terms of temptations in life, and trying to be realistic about our own personal character and makeup. Here's an interesting passage in 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 7 through 11. So this was Paul writing to those in Thessalonica, and it was clear that he formed a very close relationship with them. He describes, look in verse 7, that's the first part of this. What does he say he was like with them? He describes himself as kind of having like two kinds of relationships with them. What's the one in verse 7?
Nursing mother.
All right, he's a mother. He's like a mother to them, a nursing mother. Mm-hmm. Look down at the end of this, though. Look at the end of verse 11. He also says he was like something else. What else was he like?
Father.
Yeah. So he basically says to them, look, I was like a mom and a dad to you. I was like your mother and your father. But in doing that, in describing it, it's interesting that he describes how he was like a nursing mother. And so I put here, it's a pinkish purple kind of color here, but notice the things that describe how he acted like a mother. He was gentle. He cherished them. He was affectionately longing for them. He was pleased to impart something to them. So he was like giving, ready to give. Even he talked about giving of his own life. He talked about how dear they were to him and how he was laboring and toiling even day and night. Do you think that's a fair description of a loving mother for her young child? Does that sound right to you? I think it does. I think that well describes a woman as a mother and how she feels. And it says a little bit about the character of a mother. Now, are there fathers that are gentle and who cherish and would give up their own life and would work day and night for their children? There are. But when he describes the father, it's a little differently. Notice some of the things he says when he acted as a father does to his own children. He speaks about being devout and just, about being blameless, and this idea of exhortation and comfort. And I think that fathers are known for exhorting and kind of pushing and trying to encourage their children in a certain way. Mothers are known for their affection and gentleness with their children. So this is just one place. You can see a little bit of these differences. But there are a lot of commandments in the scriptures that recognize the fact that there is a difference between men and women, because the focus of the passage or of the commandment is specific to a man or to a woman. So here's some places in which a man is addressed to hold up holy hands without wrath or disputing. And again, let me be sure we understand. This is about the general character of men versus the general character of women. Does it mean that women, it's not important for women to be without wrath and disputing? Of course it's important. But I think in this commandment it's saying that maybe that's something that men struggle with more is the idea of wrath and disputing. So they're commanded not to look at a woman to lust, and men are told to be sober-minded and to be examples in works and doctrine and have sound speech, to love their wives as their own body. And I think a lot of these commandments are speaking to maybe what men in general may struggle with, and to dwell with their wives in knowledge and give honor. There's some things to women, too, the idea of appropriate dress and quietness and subjection. Men need to be concerned about their dress also, but there's something about that and about women that's important here. Be careful not to be busybodies or tattlers, or the need to be reverent and not slanderous. Again, think carefully about this. It's not saying that, well, men don't have these issues, but women do. Well, men have these issues. But these may be things that speak to the general character of women, that they need to focus on the quiet spirit and the respectfulness and not being afraid. I'm not going to dwell on this much, but I want to kind of turn it into this. Here are some thoughts here about these differences. And you are more than welcome to disagree with these. But it seems to me that just in general, these two lists fairly accurately describe some of the differences between men and women. Men are particularly driven by seeking after approval or respect. I don't think I've ever met a woman who didn't care about being respected also. But I think it's a little higher with men, this idea of respect. But women, perhaps, are more driven by security and by affection. Men are goal-oriented. They want to accomplish something, whereas a woman values the experience. Let me give you an example of this one. It kind of speaks to some things that are said later on this list about speech, but I've noticed this happens between men and women all the time. A wife will come, or a woman will come, and will describe a problem, a situation that's got an issue and a problem. If she comes and describes that to me, the first thing I want to do is to figure out an answer to that problem. I go into the fix-it mode right away, because I think that's the goal-oriented accomplishment side of it. Sometimes Kay comes and describes, you know, here's this problem that happened in the day, here's an issue with the children. I am on to the solution. But really all she wanted to do was just talk about it. It's the experience. It's the sharing of the information. It's the time together around this issue, not looking for me to go solve the problem. But I think that's oftentimes the difference between men and women. We men want to control things. We prefer black and white logic, whereas a lot of women want to talk things through, not necessarily in a linear way from one point to the other, just kind of talk it through in different ways. Women are more capable of thinking about many things at once. And using
is this the counseling by default, is this counseling by default, or
it could be.
I lived it longer, that's all. That's why I'm asking.
Yeah, but remember, this is about good relationships, and that's
you're right.
I'm always involved in that, right? But I think all of these kind of speak to things. Men admire emotional stability. You know what that means? We like it when emotions don't take over the situation. You know, when everybody stays calm, you don't get too upset or too, you know, excited about something. Sometimes men just like things to remain sort of calm. But women are okay with more emotions in a circumstance. And I think this last one, if it's true, what is said is paramount to men, not how it's said. You know, I found myself, I know, unfortunately, arguing that whatever I did was okay because what I said was true and right and accurate, whereas the person on the other side recognized that the way I said it was not right. It was said with the wrong tone, maybe even with the wrong look on my face, whatever it was. But a lot of times men are more concerned about what is said, but with women, it's how it's said that is paramount. Now, I want to stress, And I want to overemphasize this list. There are men who, many ways, are oftentimes could be almost described over there on the right side of this screen, and women who have more of that kind of linear thinking logic. It's what was said, not how it was said, that matters. But I think you would agree in general, these kind of describe some of the differences. Here's why it matters, and then I'll try to wrap the class up. I'd like to hear more of your perspective on this, so I may come back to this at the start of Sunday and let you challenge me or challenge the class a little bit on some of these differences. But think about this for a moment. If the left side of this, which is the way we described men, if this is the way our character is in general as men, I think it's really important for us to recognize the temptations that naturally flow out of being like that. It's not that those things on the left are bad, but they could speak to my weaknesses as a man, and particularly my weaknesses that will show up in my relationships with other people. So if I want approval and respect, I may easily be susceptible to pride, kind of demand that you respect me even when I haven't earned it. If I'm goal-oriented, it may be all about winning in the relationship, in circumstances of life, and I may be seeking to dominate or seek my own way. You know, this logic and linear thinking, I might not even be that concerned about what the truth is. I just want to be right. You know, so I start arguing my point beyond what can be justified. And it's easy for me then to become callous or impatient and not be as respectful of emotions. And I mentioned the example of being harsh in speech, but, you know, I said the right thing. I said something that was truthful. Those are temptations. Here's an interesting thing. I'm just going to put up here alongside of this. In these little blue bubble boxes or circles, those are all qualifications of elders. And what that's telling us is that God is expecting men to overcome these kinds of temptations. Because if you want to describe a godly man, he's learned not to be arrogant, not to be self-willed or quarrelsome or quick-tempered. But I think all of those are things that we need to recognize. You know what? I am susceptible to that. And then let me finish with this. I may go just a few minutes over. I understand if you have to sign off. Here was the list we had for women in terms of what may just generally describe them. What do you think are some temptations that women may face as a result? This is an accurate general picture. And if it describes you as a woman, what might you need to be especially careful about? What might be a temptation or a weakness or a sin that would be more likely?
So if I weigh my feelings more significantly, or number 7, I focus on my feelings, or number 8, my emotions, mm-hmm. You know, if I let that be my guide, then I may not be focusing on the truth of a situation, or, you know, the reality or the seriousness of something, even, you know, if I'm,
yeah,
if my,
or not even willing to listen to what God says emotions. About something. Yeah. It's good.
They may seek security or affection in the wrong person.
Okay. Yeah. Cause that's paramount sometimes, you know, is to have that. And yet, the way that it's obtained is not wise. Any other thoughts? That's Danny's point here. You compromise for the kind of security and affection that you get. You may overvalue how you feel towards somebody because it's about the experience or the emotions, a lack of willingness to confront sin. A close relationship. I like talking things through. I like being with them. So that close relationship we put more emphasis on the wisdom of that other person. Well, maybe they don't have it. Just because we're so close to them, we respect them in ways that maybe we shouldn't. The focus on people, maybe that's why women were warned about being gossips and all, because there is a care and concern more about people. And as Kay said, being swayed by our emotions or following that over the truth. All of these are some things, and the idea of not being able to be forgiving in things. Those are things that perhaps are things to be careful about.
Russ, I was going to say that when you're talking, you're not listening. So you can tend to talk and think, oh, I've got the answer, I figured it out myself, rather than actually listening to the advice that you're being given or take it into account.
Yeah, that's a good warning.
Because I'm always right.
Is that an assertion you're making there, Danny? Yeah, that's how we feel oftentimes.
I'm sitting right here.
Yeah. Thanks for joining in and speaking up. I know I kind of used the time a little unwisely and had to rush through some of these things. I do think that this is important, and it's a topic we could spend a lot more time on. But hopefully we'll kind of weave it back in some of the case studies and some other thoughts as we talk about relationships. How might the differences in our general viewpoints and character as men and women sometimes have an influence over how we have the ability to form good and godly relationships? All right. I am going to end it there. And y'all are welcome to stop. I will leave the screen up for a little bit here as you begin to sign off. But thank you again for being part of the class. The material is out there online anytime you want. I'm going to try to get these slides posted as well so you can see some of these charts and go back through them as you might choose.
Thank you, Russ.
Thank you, Russ.
My pleasure. Thanks, Russ.